We are in a momentous time. A global health pandemic, which is connected to a dramatic economic slowdown. And now a highly visible street-based struggle for black life. It is a struggle against racism, which was precipitated by police killings, but in my view, includes all of the ways in which brown and black bodies are taken for granted and in fact devalued in our social world. George Floyd's story is your story. It is our story. It is a story not just of police force in the state, but of all the many ways states police brown and black bodies, and border controls, as we know all too well, is one pivotal way. It is worth noting that when the pandemic and economic fallout hit, we had not yet finished with the consequences of the last major economic fallout, the financial crisis of 2007 and 08. The Great Recession, as some called it, imparted considerable misery across poor and marginalized communities the world over as states and capitalists sought to blame the working classes for the destruction that they caused. You will remember that the Great Recession started in the housing markets of the U.S., threatened to bring down much of the global banking system, and resulted in bailouts for the rich by the U.S. state among other states across the globe. The George Floyds of the world had to hustle to make ends meet, while states and their national banks swept in to save finance capitalists. It is no wonder, then, that the blood of brown and black bodies has continued to spill in the streets of urban centers across the United States, Canada, the rest of the Americas, and beyond. The people have had enough of the batons, big business bailouts, and bullying, the bullshit. And I'm here to say to you, we are also fed up with the borders, too. So let us talk about those borders, what they mean and do during this time of pandemic. And let's do so by thinking about what I call the layered histories of being on the land. Brown and black bodies living and working these lands and territories that we now call Canada. Canada's Health Minister, Patty Hedgedew, recently stated, "A virus does not know borders." We have witnessed and experienced this firsthand as we watched the novel coronavirus spread, supposedly from the markets of Wuhan, China, through much of the planet, hopping from body to body, some say without discrimination. And if this is true, then is it not also that racism travels too? The economic elite have their own pursuit. It is a global pursuit for profit. The Communist Manifesto puts it succinctly. The need of all constantly expanding market for its products chases the bourgeoisie over the entire surface of the globe. It must nestle everywhere, settle everywhere, establish connections everywhere. Racism is a lubricant for capitalist profit-making. But I'm here to say today that it's not just the virus and racialized capitalism that crosses borders. This reminds me of a story in Canada's sordid settler colonial history, a history that is ongoing today. It is a story about a new highway in the northernmost inhabited parts of the continent and about resistance to residential schools that I hope will resonate with listeners. You may know that the Canadian state, supported by some churches, ran residential schools for Indigenous peoples from the 1880s all the way until 1996. It was seen as a way to assimilate Indigenous peoples, a way of killing the Indian in the Indian, as I once heard said. A highway which opened on November 15th, a couple of years ago, an all-season highway connecting Inuvik to Tuktoyaktuk in what we have come to call the Northwest Territories, is the center of the story. It's actually not so much the highway that's pertinent here, but rather the crossing that occurred some 45 years earlier. That is the harrowing tale of Bernard and Reason, who, in late June 1972, set out with his two closest friends, Lawrence Jack Elenick and Dennis Dick, to flee the Stringer Hall Residential School in Inuvik. The trio of youngsters, ranging in ages from 11 to 13, set out north to trudge a pathway home to Tuktoyaktuk, 130 kilometer or so trek. As a recent CBC report puts it, there was no road, no path, except for telephone pole lines strung along the half-frozen landscape of bush, tundra, lakes, and rivers, leading to their community on the edge of the Arctic Ocean. As the report continues, they used the pole lines as markers to guide the way, ate berries, and had plenty of fresh water to drink. After more than 2 weeks, guided by the 24-hour-a-day sun experienced above the Arctic Circle in June, and reason stumbled into Tuktoyaktuk in July. Only he made it. Elenik fell ill and died during the journey. Dick pressed on instead of resting and was never found. The story is reminiscent of the desertions of countless other indigenous folks. Chaney Wenjack comes to mind. An effort is afoot to name the new highway in a way that honors Ann Reason and the other boys. Freedom Road, as one community resident recommended, who stated, "We have to remember these kids. They were running away to freedom. To get away from whatever happened or might have happened, they were fighting for their lives to reach home for freedom." This running away to freedom represents a certain kind of crossing. It is but one mode of struggle within the wider place-based geographies of survival of indigenous peoples. These stories are not only not unique amongst indigenous communities, they are familiar to the stories of freed slaves who found themselves in Canada, including in particular southern and southwestern Ontario, in search of true freedom, which they largely did not find. But it also, of course, is consistent with your own stories, the stories of migrant farm workers here in Canada, the United States, and perhaps broader. What we begin to see is the layered histories of living on the land and how crossing lands and territories becomes a crucial feature of ensuring subsistence, of struggling for survival. As Brother Fred Moten might say, "We brown and black bodies are fugitives stealing back life through our movement." So Health Minister Hejdu, a virus may not know borders, but your Canadian state and its deeply exclusionary and longstanding policies surely does. But just as the virus crosses borders, we the people, we cross them too. And we too will stop at nothing to secure the means of existence, ensure livelihoods of ourselves, of our kin. Workers too will nestle everywhere, settle everywhere, establish connections everywhere. We will cross for us, because migration, that is movement, belongs to us. It is part of the lived ways of ordinary people. It is a mode of survival. It is this commitment that must continue to inform our demands. It is one of the great fictions of our racist capitalist system that we need them. No, they need us. But yet, growers continue to offload the demands of producing and reproducing workers onto families, onto the home states, which are unwilling or incapable of supporting workers and their extended families. All of this pushes greater demands from capitalists onto workers, from the global north onto the global south, virtually always onto women, racialized women in particular. This offloading is capitalist freeloading, and we won't stand for it. What we need then is the end of border imperialism, an end to the use of national borders as ways to steal people's energies and efforts, an end to racism and gendering as it is used to devalue human life in the fields of Turtle Island and back in home countries. There is a thing that the Canadian state, growers, and other capitalists are doing during the pandemic. That is to celebrate frontline service workers on paper, turning them into heroes. It's a sort of hero worshiping. But yet denying the need for substantive or meaningful supports and change for those very heroes. We see through your charades. What we want is indigenous sovereignty now. Status on arrival and the end of immigration detention now. Meaningful social supports, employment insurance, EI, pandemic benefits during and long after this pandemic. Family reunification so that any or all kin can live here in Canada if they wish. Proper, permanent, and separate housing for each worker and their families. Local on-demand transportation not reliant upon the grower. Public childcare and schooling for workers' children. And far more ambitious demands than these. Demands aimed at transforming the unjust relations underlying the global food system. These demands are what are necessary to bring about meaningful belonging in our societies. Comrades, we need to force upon the Canadian state and growers a commitment to belonging that knows no bounds. My name is Adrian Smith. I'm a professor of law at Osgoode Hall Law School in Toronto, and I stand in solidarity with migrant farm workers and all those fighting for brown and black life.